The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Daniel Pryor is head of programs at the Adam Smith Institute. He spoke recently at a webinar entitled Street Drugs Discussion, What Does an Effective Drug Policy Look Like? We'll hear part of that in a bit. But first, I'm on the line with Haven Wheelock. She coordinates the Syringe Services Program at Outside In, a Portland service agency, and holds a master's in public health from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health in Baltimore. She's also a chief petitioner for Initiative Petition 44 on Oregon's general election ballot in 2020. Haven, first of all, what can be done in the case of opioid overdose?
So, to clarify, are we talking about an individual overdose event or the systematic issue of the overdose crisis we are currently living in?
Well, you know, let's start with the first case of what can be done at the individual level.
Yeah, at the individual level, being trained to have and use naloxone. Naloxone is a medication that is used to treat opioid overdose. It's either a nasal spray or an intramuscular injection, and it's safe and effective to use if someone is experiencing an overdose. If you do not have naloxone on hand, actually administering rescue breathing and getting help for folks as quickly as possible is really important. In those events, preventing overdoses are also really important. So making sure folks, if you are using substances, you're not using them by yourself in case something does happen, you have help and backup, is one great tool. Not mixing drugs. Different drugs have different risk for overdose and can make overdoses worse and more dangerous. Not using substances if you don't want to, and getting on medication to treat substance use disorder, if that's something that's important to you, are all options of ways to prevent overdose deaths, even if they don't prevent overdoses necessarily always.
Now, naloxone, is that available to the general public? Is it possible for people to be trained to use it?
Yeah, it varies a bit state by state, but most states now have availability of naloxone for late people to just get. Here in Oregon, you can get it at the pharmacy without a prescription, but state by state, the rules are a little different. But most places now, I believe all 50 states have legislation that allows for lay distribution of naloxone.
Outside In does trainings, right?
Hmm?
Do you do trainings?
Yeah, Outside In offers trainings for our for clients of our syringe access program, which I coordinate. We also do community-based trainings for folks as well. So I personally have trained thousands of individuals to have, carry, and use naloxone.
Now, there's new research out of UCSF Medical School that finds that a number of deaths each year have been misreported as out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, usually on the spot by doctors or EMTs who are responding. The real number of overdose deaths, extrapolating those findings to national, according to the doctor in charge of the project, Zion Sen, the real number of overdose deaths could be double what the CDC reports. Mm-hmm. Can you speculate for just a moment about the implications of that? I mean, if those findings could be applied to the nation as a whole?
I mean, so I haven't read the whole paper. I think that death data in general is, people like to think that death data is like an easy thing to get to. And so we think someone dies, cause of death, obviously we know it. But those of us in the public health world knows that it's a lot messier than that. How things are categorized, causes of death are determined, who's making those calls, varies widely across the country. There's places that use, elected officials to make those calls versus medical providers. So I think that we know that it is messier than we would like it to be. There's not a lot of standardization around how those causes of death are determined. In terms of cardiac death conflating with overdose death, I think it's really scary to think about if someone is responding to an emergency and they are assuming heart attack as opposed to overdose, are they taking the necessary steps that could be used to revive someone who is overdosing? And that, I think, would be less... I think that, like, the interventions are similar, but they are different. And so I am concerned that if someone's assuming heart attack when it is an overdose, they may be not using tools like naloxone to in that response.
And I suppose unless you've got the person's list of medications and current prescriptions, you know, right there, it would be hard to tell if it's legal prescribed medications.
Yeah, it is. And that's something like we talk about in our trainings often, is that, you know, context is really important, right? And like if someone says to me, like, because most people doing overdose response trainings aren't training chest compressions. The really important piece for an overdose response is the rescue breathing piece. And so, you know, with places that are teaching hands-only CPR, for example, where you're not actually providing breaths, you may not be providing that air that someone would need in an overdose event. And so, you know, when we're talking to clients and staff that we're training about this, it's like using context is really important, right? Like if I'm walking down the street and an elderly person collapses in front of me, I'm going to think heart attack before I think overdose. Whereas if someone says, Haven, somebody's overdosing around the corner, I'm going to assume overdose. But again, those distinctions are really hard, especially if we're talking about prescription overdoses.
We talked a moment ago about the implications at the individual level, what can be done in case of overdose at the individual level. And let's go the national level for a moment. This is a good lead-in. What could be done nationally about overdose?
I mean, there's a lot of policies that really could be helpful in terms of addressing the overdose crisis. I think big picture, making sure that everyone has access to adequate health care is really important, and adequate housing. I think addiction and substance use disorder are really fed in isolation and the trauma and in trauma. And so when folks are living outside, making adjustments to their drug use is really hard, right? Like the trauma of being outside just makes it that much harder. So improving access to housing and healthcare is crucial, and just the right thing to do for human beings. I think that increasing access to medications to treat substance use disorder, especially opiate use disorder, which we actually have some really great medications like methadone and buprenorphine that are sometimes restricted depending on people's health insurance and how you access it. So addressing those and really working on destigmatizing being on those medications. I hear all too often from folks that they're like, oh, I don't want to get on medicine to treat my addiction because it's just trading one drug for another kind of thinking. And, you know, we really don't do that with other healthcare issues. No one would ever say, I'm not going to take my insulin because, you know, I should just will my pancreas to make more insulin. But yet we do that with like substance use disorders, and it makes me very sad. I also think we need to be considering safe consumption spaces and how we are providing places for people to use substances in a safer way. Expanding access to harm reduction services and naloxone and syringe exchange services is really crucial nationally. There are places where we are doing it well, and then there are a lot of places that really don't have adequate access to those services. And so really working to build up that system of care would be really helpful.
Would decriminalizing the simple possession of some drugs, like, for instance, heroin, would that help?
Yes. It should have been on my list in the first place. I got on my healthcare brain. But I think, you know, drugs in general are, people's lives are disrupted by the fear of arrest, and it makes it a lot harder for folks to access care if they need to, if they're scared of being arrested. In my dream world, we would actually be working towards full legalization. And because having substances that are created by pharmaceutical companies as opposed to being created in labs overseas is would really help to, like, create a safer drug supply for folks. That being said, I don't think here in the U.S. until universal health care is obtainable. I actually would be very nervous about what pharma would do if all of a sudden they could start selling cocaine to people who need it and or diacetylmorphine, which is legal heroin. I worry about the access issues in terms of, like, people with money being able to have the medicine and people without means not having these medications. So I think we should work on our overall healthcare system before pushing to legalize all substances. But definitely the criminalization of substance use has continued to force mass incarceration. It makes it harder for people to access care. It also, you know, here in Multnomah County, people who died from an overdose 15 times more likely in the first 2 weeks of after leaving incarceration from our local jail. So this cycle of people going in and out of jail is actually very dangerous in terms of overdose risk. And so I definitely think if we can keep people out of jail, that will help people not die.
So I could say that voting yes on IP44 would be a harm reduction measure.
Oh, I fully would say that that is entirely true. I think anything we can do to reduce the war on drug users is really important. And IP44, which is a ballot initiative that will use marijuana tax revenue to increase access to full-spectrum harm reduction to long-term recovery supports and treatment options for folks, as well as decriminalize the basic possession of simple possession of all substances, is definitely moving us in a safer direction and a better direction for both in terms of, like, taking away the power of police over communities, but also will really help to improve people's health and the likelihood of that they will be surviving through their substance use disorder.
Again, folks, I'm speaking with Haven Wheelock. She's the coordinator of the Syringe Services Program at Outside In and holds a master's in public health from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And, Haven, I've taken a lot of your time. Just one more. I'm curious because there's a lot of concern that with the COVID lockdown, we have more people at home, possibly more people being depressed, and many of these overdose deaths being called deaths of despair. And then we also have concerns about adulteration of products on the market because of supply interruptions, and so more things get added. What do you think is going on? We don't have the data yet, but what do you think is happening out there as far as drug use on the streets?
I mean, we've seen it's been interesting since all of this started. We've definitely seen changes in drug supply markets early in the pandemic. We're not seeing it as much now, but like early in the pandemic, like, meth just disappeared off the streets, and so folks weren't able to get any, and then now it's come back. So I don't know. I'm not an expert on drug markets or cartels, but, you know, we're seeing a lot of folks we haven't seen in a very long time resuming use, coming back and coming in. I think there's no way. We know that, like you said, substance use is like a disease of despair. And so I think when you have millions and millions of people who are scared, both of the virus and of the economic results of this pandemic, people who are out of work, who historically had things to do and now aren't. It's a really key thing to resume use at times like that. And I definitely would say we have been seeing that throughout the pandemic. I think, you know, how drug markets change really fluctuates. And, you know, when you have people who aren't regularly using, sometimes using, that's a really dangerous time in terms of overdose risk. Resuming use is a dangerous time frame for doing that, especially if people are hiding it from others in their community. So, I mean, the numbers will be interesting to see going forward, but I think that it's really hard for folks who are used to being in community with others, people who are attending groups, people who are using, like, having all of those kind of things, like therapy going online. It's been a really hard time for folks, and I think that really acknowledging that is really important. And I think it's easy to, when we have such an acute viral respiratory pandemic happening, it's really easy for that to be the focus and forget that there's all these other pandemics co-occurring. The epidemic of overdose in this country, the pandemic of HIV and hepatitis C that are still affecting this community, is really, that's all still there. And so, you know, how do we balance all of those things? I don't really have an answer for it, but I think it is important work that we should be doing.
And Amy, having any closing thoughts for my listeners?
Well, thank you for taking the time to chat with me, and I hope everyone stays safe, wears your face coverings, carries naloxone.
Avon Wheelock, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was my interview with Haven Wheelock. She's a harm reduction worker who coordinates the syringe exchange program at Outside In, a Portland-area nonprofit. Outside In does a lot of really vital work. Find out how you can support their efforts by going to outsidein.org. Haven's also one of the chief petitioners for Ballot Measure 110, the Drug Decriminalization and Addiction Treatment Initiative, which appears on Oregon's 2020 general election ballot. It was originally Initiative Petition 44. At the time we recorded the interview, the article we were talking about was still embargoed, and the ballot measure had yet to be assigned. So, portions of this interview can also be heard on another show I produce called Free Culture Radio, which is also syndicated through the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Daniel Pryor is head of programs at the Adam Smith Institute. He conducts original policy research and is responsible for organizing the ASI's events as well as running the Institute's education programs. He spoke recently on a webinar entitled Street Drugs Discussion, What Does an Effective Drug Policy Look Like? Let's give a listen.
I guess to start off, my name is Daniel Pryor. I'm head of programs at the Adam Smith Institute. And for those of you who aren't familiar with us, we're a policy-focused free market think tank based in London. So we take a kind of classical liberal free market view on various policy issues. And as well as trying to change government policy in various areas, we also try and change public opinion as well. And we do that in a number of ways. So things like media advocacy, but mainly our policy research. And I'm the guy at the ASI office at the moment who concentrates most extensively on drug policy in various different forms. And to give you an idea of where we stand and the sort of work we're doing in the broader drug policy field, we've supported cannabis legalization and more broadly drug reform relating to other substances since pretty much we were founded in the late 70s. And it's a thread in our work that's continued for decades. Most recently, we've just released last week a paper looking on the medicinal side of reform for psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, and looking at how that can be best harnessed to treat treatment-resistant depression and various other cases of mental ill health. We also look at the kind of harm reduction side of things when it comes to drug policy. So we're firm supporters of drug consumption rooms, as well as things like festival drug testing. But I guess the kind of centerpiece of what we focus on most is in relation to legalization of various different substances, but particularly cannabis is the one that's been mentioned and the one that we focused on most in terms of our research and our advocacy most recently. And there are, as Niamh has already said, there are some very good reasons to care about drug reform, whether it's decriminalization or legalization. We're in a situation in the UK where a huge amount of people have used drugs on a regular basis. I mean, one in three people in England and Wales have tried cannabis at some form in their life. One in 10 young people have tried Class A drugs in the past year. And we're also in the situation where, as Niamh mentioned, drug death rates are extremely high in Scotland. They are the highest currently in the European Union. And we think that at the moment, there's actually quite a good impetus for change in relation to the legalization of cannabis. So if you look at the most recent polling, you're starting to see majority public support. And that's fairly well distributed across age groups and political party, although obviously there's some differences. If you look at, for example, the breakdown of polling for support of legalizing cannabis, then if I had Lib Dems and Labour, fairly unsurprisingly, there's majority support, whereas it's split around 50-50 amongst Conservative voters. I guess kind of to go over some of the problems that I see with our current approach to drug regulation more broadly, and Niamh has mentioned several of them. There's the obvious easy youth access, the classic drug dealers don't ask for ID. We've got unregulated, more dangerous substances as a result of contamination, uncertain potency, drugs currently being missold as other substances, and no health information or quality control. And of course, our huge violent criminal market, which is worth billions. Overall, the UN, I believe, has estimated that the overall world market in illicit drugs is around 1% of global GDP. And of course, the end result of this is that you end up with organized crime growing in power and often subsidizing other crimes with the proceeds of drug sales. There's a postcode lottery in terms of enforcement of our drug laws in the UK as well. Different police forces continue to enforce what we have on the books, varying levels of intensity. And this is something that if you're a kind of someone who's concerned about the rule of law, it's not a good situation. There's this kind of idea that, well, we don't have a war on drugs when it comes to, say, cannabis, for example, because it's not enforced as harshly as it could be. I think that is complete nonsense, to be honest. There's been hundreds of thousands of criminal convictions for cannabis possession in England and Wales in the past decade or so. As Niamh mentioned, there's some racialized enforcement aspects, which are a particularly large issue. And there's very strong evidence that the kind of criminal records and cautions that people are getting on a regular basis from our current system destroys lives. Criminal records can affect people's housing, employment prospects, travel prospects, much, much more. And of course, again, the one that's kind of been in the news more recently is in relation to the growth of County Lines gangs and the child exploitation and trafficking that's involved in that. There's thousands of teenagers who are estimated to be involved in County Lines drug smuggling operations, and that's just in London alone, and human trafficking in relation to the domestic UK drug industry is fairly well documented. So onto the kind of the question of this webinar of what's the best way, what's the best legal approach to this? Well, the first thing that pops into many people's heads is, well, we should simply double down and we should actually increase our enforcement. And the big problem is that we're not enforcing the laws that we have on the books enough. We need to dedicate more resources to policing and enforce our existing laws. As Niamh said, there's very little evidence that this affects overall prevalence rates and use rates. Alex Stevens has done some great work on this. The Home Office themselves have found no association between the levels of enforcement of drug laws and the overall levels of illicit drug use. And it's also important that we distinguish between drug use and what could be described as problem drug use, because they're not the same thing. And prevalence is not a very good way of measuring harm when you've got all these other factors that I've mentioned coming into things as well. It also doesn't seem to dent supply harsh enforcement. If you look at the kind of the situations where you'd expect there to be very harsh enforcement, we obviously can't keep drugs out of our prisons. We obviously can't keep them away from our borders, the two of the most kind of policed and enforced areas in the UK. And of course, the other point that I'd make is, as a kind of classical liberal, as a free marketeer, I think that there's a principled objection to this. If you buy a liberal view on the freedom for informed adults to decide their version of the good life, then actually you'd kind of oppose this on principle as well.
That was Daniel Pryor, head of programs at the Adam Smith Institute. He spoke recently on a webinar entitled Street Drugs Discussion, What Does an Effective Drug Policy Look Like? You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The nonprofit Global Exchange recently held a webinar entitled Connecting the Dots, Drug War, Mass Incarceration, and the Movement for Black Lives. One of the speakers was the incoming executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, Cassandra Frederick.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that is like so amazing to me, and this is actually one of the, it's part of the reason why my work with Latino justice is so important, is because when we think about the drug war, oftentimes people think about it through the lens of criminal justice. But the drug war in its design was a xenophobic policy around immigration, right? So the first drug laws were against Chinese migrants. You know, marijuana laws were against Mexican folks in the Southwest. And these were about the propaganda around it was creating this idea that foreigners were hurting Americans, Americans being white. And they used drugs as a way to ostracize this group of non-white populations as a reason why we should be scared that they are in our land, right? And then they contextualize that immigration and xenophobic fear with the praxis of criminalization, right? So in order to make people hate people that are not white, they big up their differences. They make it seem as if these people that are non-white, non-English speaking are the worst thing that can ever happen to the white infrastructure of the US. And then they use criminalization as the tool to really reinforce xenophobic fears and propaganda, and use it as a way. The drug laws are one of the first ways of this make America great again, make America white again. Like, these are the first ways, like, the drug war is an immigration policy, right? It is draconian immigration policy, and it is draconian criminal justice work. And so this idea that immigration and criminal justice are separate, are different. It's not real, right? It is different strategies from the same root.
That was Cassandra Frederick, incoming executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, speaking on a webinar hosted by Global Exchange entitled Connecting the Dots, Drug War, Mass Incarceration, and the Movement for Black Lives. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Be sure to check out Dean's video project, Becker's Buds. You can find links at DrugTruth.net. Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are also on the network homepage at DrugTruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.